Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Movie Geeks United.
Wow, that was quite a loud and euphoric opening there. Yeah, welcome. Welcome to our show.
I'm trying to wake myself up. It's just a lot. What is Wednesday considered?
It's hump day.
Is Monday? Wednesday's hump day.
Wednesday's hump day. See, you've gotten over the hump. Tomorrow's Thursday, so everyone's excited. And Friday, no one does anything because the weekend's essentially here. So.
Every week on Thursday, I'm like, the week's not over yet, the work week. It just feels like it should be over.
Yes, it does.
Yeah. So this is another episode of our continuing series of interviews with Oscar nominees, and tonight we're spotlighting two such nominees, Mr. Armando Iannucci, who is up for Best Adapted Screenplay for his political satire In the Loop, and Mr. Barney Berman, who is up for Best Makeup for Star Trek. So we got some exciting conversation going on tonight.
Yeah, definitely.
Also of interest, both interviews were conducted right off the heels of the Oscar nominee luncheon. Now, this is the event where all the nominees from all the categories get together. It's their one chance to kind of socialize and rub shoulders with each other. And it's always a pleasant experience for them.
Right, oh, definitely.
Speaking of euphoric, I mean, that's a lot of these guys that never get to brush elbows with some of their idols.
Mm-hmm. We talked especially Bobby about that. It's, it's got to be something to be in a room with all of that, idols, talent, the creativity in that room alone is mind-blowing.
Yeah.
It's just, I can't even comprehend that, being in a room with all those people.
Yeah. So they both discuss being part of that luncheon. The Oscar ceremony, they announced, the latest announcement about the actual ceremony, is that they're cutting the best song performances.
Mm-hmm.
Last year they truncated them, if you remember. I think it was last year, where they were just allowed to sing like a minute of each, and Peter Gabriel backed out because he said, I won't do that to my song.
Right.
Which I completely understood. Here's my opinion. It might not be a majority opinion. It might not be a popular one, but it's how I feel. I don't think there should be musical numbers in the Oscars for one reason, because they have no place in the Oscars, except for the performances of the best song nominees.
Right.
That actually has something to do with the ceremony.
Right.
I can't for the life of me understand why they would have musical numbers in the Oscars and exclude performances of the actual nominated songs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I do agree with that. I actually think anything that you can do at this point to streamline the show, though, it is beneficial, and I think that's what they're trying to do. I do, but just the announcement you made, Oscar, it seems like every day there's something regarding the ceremony. They're really trying to keep this in the public eye because they really want people to tune in so badly.
Yeah, and I think it's pulling away from the Oscars' appeal to people that actually watch the Oscars every year. But they're changes. But first of all, this is nothing new. Every year they say we're trying to shorten the ceremony.
Yeah.
I think they've just got to admit it ain't happening with the Oscars.
No, it's
going to be a 3.5-hour show, whatever you do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't see how you shorten it. Even though they've taken all these steps and everything, I just don't see how you're going to But did you? What about this other announcement they made about the two speeches? You can't thank mom or anyone in your speech. You can do that backstage, but you can't do that.
Right.
You can't do that on the air.
Yeah. I mean, they're cutting the wrong stuff.
Yeah. And the next, we're cutting the presenters.
Why don't you just cut the awards? Why don't you do an Oscars without the awards if you want to save time?
Yeah.
Because that makes as much sense as some of the cuts that they're proposing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. We'll have to see how this plays out. And the other story that I read today over at the Wrap on their Oscar, their daily Oscar thing, is Inglourious Basterds has become the dark horse that could take.
Oh, yeah.
But they're saying they're taking away from both Hurt Locker and Avatar. They say it's no longer a two-horse race. It's really a three-horse race. And
I think it's a three-horse race, too.
I think, you know, there's no doubt about it. I mean, we talked about this a couple months ago, how it was gaining, you know, currying favor with voters, and people are really still, it's still in the public eye, and then people still talk about it. And there's no denying, he's been all over. Like, he was on Rachel Maddow last week, and that was a very exciting interview. So I definitely think he has a shot this year in a lot of the major categories.
Yeah, I mean, God knows I haven't been able to reach him.
and that surprises me. But I read something very interesting about him the other day, and he says, I just wish the critics, and this goes for all of us, would review the film and not trying to, like, one-up me on the references and everything.
Yeah.
Just review the bloody film. It was cool. I was like, yeah, dude, I get it. I mean, we know what you're referencing, and sometimes we don't. But, yeah, no, they should reference you, because a lot of times it's just like people, like, say, oh, he's just, like, paying homage to this and that, and there's nothing
right
there. And I completely agree with that. I see what he's saying.
I do, too. And it's interesting because the same can be applied to Scorsese, because obviously he has Shutter Island coming out this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
Scorsese promotes it, though. I mean, Scorsese has come out with articles, lists of films that inspired specific shots and scenes in Shutter Island. He's always embraced his influences.
He's saying this is a major, for him at least, I read somewhere, it was a major Hitchcockian.
Right. It's his Vertigo, kind of.
Yeah. And there's also, I was reading Peter Travers' review this morning in Rolling Stone, and he points out Shock Corridor, Out of the Past, and
right,
there's some other films I would never have thought of that he's saying that it's influenced by, and there's specific shots. So it's very curious.
He does that with every film. I mean, if you listen to a Scorsese commentary,
yeah,
it's a cinematic history lesson.
Right.
What fascinates me is, with both these guys, and I think they're the two best examples of this.
Mm-hmm.
The line between drawing on inspirations from the past and maintaining and putting them in a blender and coming out with something of your own style.
Yeah.
And these two guys have done it, and I'm not sure how they achieve that dynamic. I don't know that you can articulate how you achieve that.
Yeah, I don't know how either. The only other director that's alive right now who does that especially when it comes to old Hollywood films, is Pedro Almodovar, who's very good at homaging Douglas Sirk and Billy Wilder and a lot of the old Hollywood greats. He loves those, especially in Broken Embraces. There's a lot of that in there. I would say he's the only other director alive who can do that. I think the three of them, and I think you're absolutely right. Not a lot of other people, you know, that hey, he's making this director so and so is making a wink to that film, but that's all it is. There's nothing else there. Whereas with these guys, it's totally, like you said, putting in a blender and coming out with something new.
Yeah. Meanwhile, reviews for Shutter Island have been pretty uniformly stellar. And I've spoken of this before, but with an air of this is beneath Scorsese.
Yeah, I'm getting that too.
In a genre film.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like that. That's an example of something that we were discussing the other week. That's an example of elitist snobbery.
Yeah, I agree. Because aren't all, in one sense, all of the film's genres, the gangster film or the period piece, I mean, aren't they all genre films? They're all have...
Mm-hmm.
part of a genre. I mean, so yeah, I don't know. But look, when he does something like Kundun or something, he gets hammered too.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
He can't win. He tries, and he does try a lot of in the 90s. The Age of Innocence, another one. I was thinking about that today. What a wonderful film that is. And you know, he's always trying something new. He does go. I mean, he goes back to the crime film like The Departed or something, and does it very well. And he's made two remakes that are actually very, very exceptional remakes. I mean, and I love the originals of both of those films, but he brought something new and added something. And I think what I like about the Cape Fear remake is how he incorporated Robert Mitchum and Gregory Peck. I thought that was just a stroke of genius.
And it's typical of him to pay tribute to those older films, and that's a way that he would do it.
I
think that Scorsese is accomplished enough that he is his own genre.
Yeah.
I mean, he's like Spielberg. You know, you're watching a Spielberg movie. It's Spielbergian.
Yeah.
There's Scorsese is his own genre. That's how
right.
that's how great he is.
Mm-hmm.
I think.
Yeah. No, he is. You get so much, I think, when you watch a Martin Scorsese film. You just get a lot for your money.
Yeah. So that opens this weekend, so we'll be talking about that later. Shelley, my girlfriend, saw it and said she adored it, that it was awesome.
Okay,
so.
That's cool. There we go. And she was right about The Wolfman.
Yes. Even though The Wolfman, this was a huge weekend for the box office this past
week.
Yeah.
The Wolfman was the only one that really looked appealing. And I kept thinking of the Ang Lee version of the Hulk is all that it reminded me of. I mean, in a good and bad ways. I mean, it's not a horrible film, but it's, I think Shelley said it, but she could take it or leave it. And, you know, you're just like, you walk out, you're like, yeah, what was all that about?
Right.
But it had its moments. They don't use some people enough. Like, Emily Blunt is sadly just only, I think she's only in 20 minutes of the film. But she's sadly wasted in the film. And, I mean, they obviously are the special effects and everything, but I got to tell you, at the end of the day, it's the Lon Chaney one is the one that you'll remember, not this one.
Yeah. I mean, Del Toro said as much. He said, look, we're not better than the Lon Chaney.
Yeah.
And I think it originated just from Del Toro wanting to play the Wolfman.
Yeah.
I mean, he produced it. He kind of mounted the project in a way based on that desire.
Mm-hmm.
Which is fine. I mean, movies can originate any way they want to, but you know, that movie had some production problems that I think are apparent in the.
Yeah, there's definitely some stuff that you can tell. Like, you're wondering where it's going. There's a whole. I don't even know if it pays it, because when I say it reminds me of the Hulk, I'm talking about a specific plot point in the Ang Lee one. That's very apparent in this.
The father son thing.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. We can talk about. Yeah. I mean, once that's introduced into, and you sort of know that's coming. I mean, it's no secret, really. I mean, within 15 minutes, you know that's coming. All I could think of was like the whole Nick Nolte, Eric Bana thing in The Hulk. I mean, that's all I could really. And there's a sort of a level of ridiculousness to that, and it's definitely apparent in this one too.
Yeah, and I love watching interviews. I mean, I've always been a fan of interviews anyway, but since we've been doing interviews, I realize how many people are bad at it. Because I see the press junkets, and I see the people going in and out.
Yeah.
And one guy sits there with Anthony Hopkins and says, so you've done Dracula, and you've done Wolfman. Are you going to do Frankenstein?
Wow, that's just...
I guess it's a 1 + 1 + 1 kind of question, but and it takes everything, especially for a guy like Anthony Hopkins, just not to look at him and you know, throw off an insult or something.
Yeah, I know. Ask him about if he'll do another. I still haven't seen the movie he directed, Slipstream. I still need to see that. But I did like the one he made a couple years ago, The World's Fastest Indian, about the motorcycle. I thought that was pretty good. I mean, he makes some really, given the right material, he makes some wonderful films. It's sad, though, that sometimes it was Brian Cox, I think, said it best, because he was asked if he about the Hannibal Lecter part, and he said he was always glad he never played it again because he feels that Anthony Hopkins became too identified with the role.
Right.
And he was, you know, and he said Anthony Hopkins, you know, there's a whole generation that only knows Hopkins doing Hannibal Lecter, and, you know, he can do so much more. We know he can do so much more. I mean, he does a lot of them. I mean, his Nixon is just one of those powerhouse performances. That's a great – that's just a crazy, insane powerhouse performance.
Well, it's built to challenge him, too, because I find that so often when – I mean, we've talked about it countless times on the show. Our legends, our great actors, they're – finest performances are usually earlier in their career when they're hungry.
Mm-hmm.
But when you have a Anthony Hopkins that gets a hold of a character like Nixon,
mm-hmm.
and it's really a character that he is absolutely nowhere near the first name you'd think of to portray Nixon.
That's right.
It really inspires him to stretch and engage in a way that a younger actor would. You know, with
right.
the same enthusiasm and intensity, and it shows. I mean, it's one of his best in the latter part of his career.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you watched something like, I guess the last thing that I remember seeing a couple of years ago, the one where he made with Ryan Gosling, Fracture, and that's sort of, you know, that's like, I hate to say it, but that's like typecasting for him. I mean, we know he can play that part, you know, with his hands tied behind his back, his eyes closed, he can do that in his sleep. I mean, there's no challenge in a role like that. That's like recreating the part that he played, like in Magic or something.
Fewer and fewer of those actors choose roles that, from my point of view anyway, that scare them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's absolutely essential to grow. But maybe they're in a point where they think, you know, it's old hat now. I know this. I've got this. But maybe they don't.
Course,
I mean, actors are, by their very nature, insecure. So that's probably completely wrong, that viewpoint. But Pacino just announced a new movie. It starts shooting March 22nd, I think, in New York.
Oh, I thought you were going to say in Tampa.
No. yeah, 45 minutes away. No, he's doing a movie called Son of No One. With Channing Tatum.
Wow.
Directed by the Guide to Recognizing Your Saints and fighting director. Somebody that's been working with Channing Tatum a lot.
Yeah, well, no, A Guide to Recognizing Your Saints is a very good movie, very underrated movie. Fighting's one of those movies you watch and you're just like, why did someone invest in this? Nothing really happens. It had a very – we talk about some of these movies that have a made-for-TV quality to it. Fighting is definitely one of those movies. It feels like almost a pilot for a show, to be very honest with you, from what I remember. So Pacino's going to be in the movie, you know, with this latest heartthrob.
Well, and that's another thing that's bothered me about this part of Pacino's career. Everybody talks about the bombastic Pacino.
Mm-hmm.
I still think he's turned in stellar work. If you look at Insomnia or Merchant of Venice, what more do you need?
Yeah, no, especially Insomnia. That was a really good – and a very underrated movie. But that's very good.
The other thing that bothers me – is that it's another, it seems like another, maybe it's not, older guy, young guy taking under his wing. But I actually don't think, which he's done in Devil's Advocate and City Hall,
mm-hmm.
and on and on and on. Donnie Brasco,
Donnie
Brasco, another great performance of the last 14 years.
yeah, we're getting there. okay, I was wondering what your range is.
Author. No, I think it's another kind of cop story.
I wouldn't mind seeing him play him. And I know we just saw him play a cop with his buddy Robert De Niro in Righteous Kill, but I wouldn't mind seeing him play another.
And this is a role vacated by De Niro that Pacino picked up.
Oh, really? I did not know that. All right.
Yeah. But the good news is he's doing Jack Kevorkian for Barry Levinson.
Mm-hmm.
and they've never worked together, and I'm expecting great things from that.
Yeah.
That's done and in the can. And if you look at see stills from him in that movie, he looks amazing.
Yeah.
And he's and then he's doing something, I think he's doing Merchant of Venice on the stage in New York, Central Park, over the summer.
Right.
And then he's doing King Lear and on film for Michael Radford.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that would be very good.
Yeah, and then he's bought the rights to the book, a book called The Humbling, that Buck Henry is writing the screenplay for right now. So,
well, that should be very good.
Yeah. So I'm excited about that. Hey, our mystery movie score of last week.
I got it with some help, though.
You did get it. It was this, play a little snippet of this. Oh, it's so quiet. Let me see if I can raise the volume. Anyway, James Newton Howard, Signs,
nice.
Mystery movie score of last week. So the past 2 weeks we've had Signs and Gorky Park. What will the mystery movie score be this week? Stay tuned for the end of the show and you'll find out. Okay, in the loop, one of the smartest, savviest political satire / screwball comedies of recent years, and it's been nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay. It's directed and co-written by Armando Iannucci, and we spoke to him a few days ago, just right after the Oscar nominee luncheon, and he had a lot to tell us about the process of bringing In the Loop to fruition and the excitement of being nominated for an Oscar. This is a really clever, fast-paced, funny movie.
I couldn't stop laughing. I really couldn't.
It's very funny.
Oh, it's hysterical.
And it's got some just incredibly gut-bursting lines in it, dialogue.
Yes, it does.
And it's very unique because in this interview we discussed like the difference between and In the Loop and a Doctor Strangelove, like a difference in tone.
Mm-hmm.
This feels so much more screwballish because those are the kinds of movies that Iannucci is most inspired by.
Right.
So it's a unique dynamic. So let's go ahead and play this interview. Here's Armando talking about In the Loop.
He did not say unforeseeable. You may have heard him say that, but he did not say that, and that is a fact.
I apologize for Malcolm. Don't apologize for me. Apologize for yourself.
Is war unforeseeable, Minister?
To walk the road of peace, sometimes we need to be ready to climb the mountain of conflict.
Climb the mountain of conflict? He's talking about Nazi Julie Andrews.
The PM wants you to go to Washington. Talk to as few people as possible. That'd be best for you.
I'm gonna blow the cake.
I feel like we should have hookers. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
You want girls?
No. Absolutely not.
Who's Simon Foster?
He said war was unforeseeable, and I think he could be very useful on the war committee.
You're gonna use him as a little meat puppet.
He might be a scary little poodle back in London, but here you're nothing.
What is going on?
You're like the woman from The Omen. You've given birth to a demon, and now it's gonna kill you.
This will be the vote to commence military intervention.
It mentions the bomb.
How do I know you're...
I don't want to back a war.
What?
What?
You're an idiot.
Have you ever even actually killed anybody?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, falling asleep from someone, that doesn't count.
Don't leave your boss twisting in the wind and then bursting late, smelling like a pissed seaside donkey.
Where's the war committee?
Do you like how I'm telling you what's going on where you are?
Hoity toity.
Hey, buddy, stop the curse words, all right?
Kiss my sweaty balls, you fat.
This is the problem. Civilians wanted to go to war. Once you've been there, you never want to go again unless you actually have to. It's like France.
How are things going on this Oscar campaign?
Fine. We've just come back from our nominees' lunch, which was very entertaining.
Right.
I think it was quite good, actually, because it sort of breaks the ice and makes you realize that you have, in fact, been nominated for an Oscar.
Right.
Because up till now, you don't quite accept that that's the case.
Right. Yes. Well, I want to talk about that, but first, I think, you know, I want to talk about your movie first. And In the Loop. And first, I want to talk about the kind of the tone of the film, which is kind of this political satire mixed with screwball comedy. And I'm kind of curious if those were genres that you grew up admiring, had an affinity for? Cause, I mean,
oh, absolutely. I mean, interestingly, this film came about because I wanted to make a screwball comedy. I didn't realize, you know, I would end up making one about a war, let alone a war that is based on a very, very recent one. You know, I love those, you know, fast-talking films, 40s and 50s, and, you know, Preston Sturges, and or Hold the Front Page, or you know, really zappy, funny dialogue with a sort of increasingly outrageous plot that just gets worse and worse and worse, madder and madder and madder, but tighter and tighter and tighter. That was the sort of starting point. And, you know, and I kept thinking, you know, I want to wait till I've got a good idea or a good story to tell, really. And then as I was reading more and more, and then finding out more and more about what actually went on in Washington in the lead up to the invasion of Iraq and the dysfunction within the different departments, different, you know, the Pentagon not speaking to the State Department and the State Department not being spoken to by the White House, and how also the Brits were kind of sucked into this whole thing and, you know, slightly used. I thought that's a farce. If it weren't so awful what happened as a result, you're looking at a stupid, stupid story. And I thought, well, that's the story I want to tell. That is my screwball comedy. But also, I am a big fan of films like Dr. Strangelove or Brazil or The Great Dictator, the Charlie Chaplin film, where, you know, comedy, or in the case of Brazil, I suppose, fantasy, can take on big topics, and you're not really demeaning that topic by making a comedy out of it. You're just, you know, just comedy allows you to examine it from, you know, every conceivable and unusual angle. And so I felt very comfortable with the notion of doing, you know, fundamentally a screwball comedy about a very contemporary war. And I wanted to make sure that as we wrote the film and as we made it, you know, the emphasis was on the comedy, but the comedy had to be underpinned by a sense of reality that you're kind of eavesdropping on what really does go on behind the scenes. But at all time, you know, you're kind of laughing at the same time, so you're left with that strange... people say that they come away from the film, you know, having laughed themselves silly throughout, but come away feeling a little bit kind of sick inside, because when they realize that, you know, it's probably all true.
Well, and the thing is, I think one thing is uniquely unique about In the Loop is that, you know, everyone always talks about, when they talk about political satire, they bring up Strangelove, and Dr. Strangelove is a great political farce satire, but, you know, Kubrick's film is very nasty. It has this acidic kind of almost nihilistic view, and you seem to take a different approach, and which is kind of profound in a way, in that you don't you see the humor in this, and there's a little bemusement, but you still, I don't think there's that acidic nihilism that, you know, was in Strangelove.
I don't know. I mean, I love Dr. Strangelove, but with Dr. Strangelove, you know, you have the president, the president of Russia and the U.S. president, so, and you're at the United Nations, so it's very big. You're on a big stage, and these are big public figures. I knew that when I was doing In the Loop, I wanted not to go that high, to stay with the middle people, really, the office workers, the little ones kind of beavering away in the background, because, you know, I wanted to show how very real incidents are a result of, you know, the actions that a lot of very real people do or choose not to do. So there was that element of it, and therefore I wanted to make it feel like it was couched in reality. I mean, with Strangelove, it's very much set in a hyper absurd world.
Right. Right.
You know, that's deliberate. and the sets are very grand and stark and otherworldly in a way. With this, it's certainly not a glamorous look that we've got in the film. And also, I suppose what I didn't want to do is say these are the bad guys and these are the good guys, because it's not really about that. I don't think any of them are evil. I don't think any of them woke up in the morning and said, do you know what I feel like doing today? I feel like starting a pointless war that will lead to the loss of hundreds of thousands of lives. You know, that didn't happen. I think everyone went into it feeling that they were either right or they had the best intentions. But it's just all about how they increasingly get a little bit wrong all the time, to the extent that cumulatively something goes very wrong. And then it's then a point of where, if they're aware of this, what do they do? Some of them choose to sort of change their mind. Others choose to ignore their realization that they're going down a strange path. You know, so I certainly wanted the audience not to, you know, maybe to have different views of certain characters at the end of the film than they did at the start, and to ask themselves all the time, you know, what would I do under those circumstances, really?
Part of the film gets some of its inspiration origins from your show, your series, The Thick of It.
Yeah.
And you've done other series for the BBC and so forth. So I'm curious on that training ground of television, of you know, limited series television that the British television is amazing for. How is that training, or what did you take from that when you decided to do this film?
Well, I suppose plot construction, having to do things quickly. We had a very low budget on the TV show, so we had to kind of improvise. And I had to shoot, you know, I would shoot a 30-minute episode in 3.5 days. There's flexibility, I suppose, you know, because you have a low budget and you're not, with the TV show, you're not, it's not like there are major, huge studios behind it. There's flexibility, so that allowed me to experiment a bit in the working method and the shooting style, but also in the acting style, blending in a little bit of slight improvisation along with the script. It's things like that that... And then when we moved to the film, you know, it's a case of wanting to justify its existence as a movie and you know, playing with a larger framework, the you know, the Washington and London, the transcontinental setting, the United Nations, the bigger cast of characters, you know, relishing that, but at the same time not losing the kind of the intimacy that you get in doing the TV show, or indeed the pace. You know, with a TV show, you've got 30 minutes, so you have to hurry things along. I kind of wanted to keep that in the film, and I didn't want to, because I was making a film, feel I had to bring in, you know, cliched movie elements like a big soundtrack or, you know, beautifully shot skylines, you know, with
right.
the sun rising over London here and sinking over Washington. I didn't want that because I wanted to preserve that sense that what the audience were getting was sort of reality, was a sort of almost like a documentary or the unedited rushes of something that they weren't really meant to be seeing in that condition, you know, until it had been sanitized. So it's a case of trying to, you know, enjoy the broader, you know, the greater opportunities in making a film, while at the same time trying not to be carried away by it and to keep the sense of it feeling, to sort of keep me out of it in a way, to keep me as the director out
right.
of it. I didn't want it to feel directed. I wanted it to feel this is just a random selection of stuff, of what went on.
Right. Well, speaking of pacing and you know, keeping it going, I got to ask then about, you know, the supposed, I mean, and I'm fully aware that director's cuts are always long, those first rough assembly, you know, assembly of everything are always long. But this one was, you know, it's famously been reported as 4.5 hours long, and so
The first cut was 4.5 hours, but the director's cut is what is in the cinema and on the DVD, because I wanted to get it down to. I always think, you know, a comedy starts out staying its welcome after about 1 hour 40 or 1 hour 45. So I got the, I wanted to get the playing down, time down to 1 hour 40. It's probably the first instance of a director's cut being shorter than, you know, what everyone else wanted. And I found that it was easy to get it down to 2 hours. You know, the hard bit, the final couple of months effort was getting it down to taking that final 20 minutes out. And in the end, I took my three favorite scenes out. They were my favorite scenes because they had great performances in them and they were very funny, self-contained moments, but they kept holding the action up at just the wrong point. They kept disrupting the rhythm. And I kept moving them about and tried to save them and everything. And in the end, I took them out, and the film felt a lot better for it. And I thought, well, you know, thank heavens for DVD deleted scenes, because people will get to see them.
Right.
And that's great. Pardon me, quick sneeze there on the podcast. But the film felt so much better. And it's at that point that you realize that the film is all about being... You know, the whole has to be greater than the sum of its parts. And it's not about putting all your favorite bits in. It's
right.
about telling the story and making the story unravel naturally and keeping the audience interested. And on top of that, because it's a comedy, keeping them amused at all times. And so it was about that. So I don't think the four-hour version should ever see the light of day. I think that's one for just, you know,
right.
people involved in the film, just to remind them of what we did.
And so I got to ask about casting. I want to ask about is casting Gandolfini in a part against what he's known for. And there's a lot of stuff going on with the casting of Gandolfini, in that he came to prominence on The Sopranos, which The Sopranos kind of brought the ethos of British television of limited series runs and seasons.
And now he's in this.
And so what was that casting process like in getting him?
Well,
with
James, I mean, it was very easy. I had been talking to him and his production company about another project, and as a result, he had seen the thick of it and, you know, absolutely loved it. And as we were writing the film, this part of General Miller, the Pentagon general, the general who says he's opposed to the war, but can he actually follow it through? This part came up, and I just thought, you know, he would be really interesting to see in this part, because it is casting against type. It's not what you'd expect. But he is a naturally funny, you know, when you meet him, you realize he's an actor. You know, Tony Soprano is a part that he plays, and he has this other range and a sort of a comedy. He has a great comic instinct for timing and delivery of the line, and also there's a little bit of slapstick involved in how he, you know, how he works the comedy visually. He's a big fan of W.C. Fields.
Right.
And so that was interesting. But also, I was also playing on this thing of, you know, in the lead up to Iraq, Tony Blair and his entourage, you know, his other cabinet team who went out, did get a bit starstruck when they went out to Washington. They did get excited about being in the Oval Office. They got excited about seeing George Bush. You know, it was like tourists going to Disneyland or sort of young, fresh actors going to Hollywood for the first time. You know, they got really quite starstruck. And therefore, to convey that in the film, I thought it was important that there was someone there who did have a sense of, oh, there's that person. You know, I've only seen him on the telly, but I'm seeing him. I'm in the same room as him. and so we kind of brought that. And we wrote into the script, you know, that Toby, the Chris Addison's character, the young guy, is genuinely thrilled to see General Miller. And, you know, at the end, he wants to go up and actually have a word with him. And it almost looks like he's about to ask for his autograph. You know, it's that sense of kind of being started. And I kind of wanted to get that, because that is what happened. You know, I was told by some people at the State Department that when Blair went out, the State Department never knew, was never told by the White House what was going on. So whenever Blair went out for a meeting with George Bush, he would then be invited over to the State Department so that they could ask him what went on. But he was so, had such an adrenaline rush from the meeting that he could hardly speak. They called it White House lockjaw. You know, when they asked him what went on in the meetings, he was just going, you know, and I just thought, you know, you've lost your dignity, sir. and I just wanted, you know, I just wanted to convey that. So it was a very easy, and James, you know, he saw the script, loved it. We met up in New York. He said, let's do it. You know, I said, we're only shooting for about a month or so. Some scenes in Washington, some of it is we're going to shoot in London. He said, let's go for it. And he was great. And we do a bit of workshopping and improvisation in the rehearsal period, you know, with the writers there. And we did a week of that in New York, and, you know, James was there for that as well. He went off to the Pentagon. He did his own research, went off to the Pentagon. You know, being James Gandolfini, he can pick up a phone and say, you know, can I walk around the Pentagon? And they were all starstruck. They said, yeah. So he went around and he watched them. He just, you know, observed and watched how they carried themselves, how they spoke. He went to the barbers and had a Pentagon haircut. So he did his, you know, he did his research and stuff.
Well, and so the film came out and it becomes a critical and big success here, you know, both over, you know, in your home country and in here and so forth. And so, I mean, what was it like? Is this Oscar nomination, is this kind of icing on the cake, as they like to say?
Oh, absolutely. It's not something we'd ever, you know, imagined would be the final, the kind of the last bit in the process. You know, you make the film because you want to make it, and then it's all really about trying to make it as much as, you know, as much control over it and trying to get the film into the shape that you've always wanted it to be. So that's the first challenge. And then it's released. And then the big reward for that is just hearing audiences laugh. You know, I grew up watching film comedy and sitting, you know, in the dark with loads of people laughing at, you know, Airplane and Woody Allen and Spinal Tap and stuff like that. So, you know, that was my big ambition, just to make something that would make a lot of people in the room in the dark laugh. So it was great when that happened. Everything after that has been an absolute bonus, unplanned, you know, I couldn't have hoped for this. So this is great, you know, and just coming back from the Oscars nominees lunch today, you know, it suddenly just felt real. You know, up till now, you know, I've been saying to people we've been nominated for an Oscar, but I've been thinking, but that's for the other Oscars, isn't it? You know, the one that are held in a separate hotel and not televised, you know, you know, it's
right.
Not real. And today you suddenly realize it was real. And it was thrilling, you know. I don't expect anything beyond this, you know. I'd be absolutely astonished if we won.
What was that luncheon like? Who did they place you next to, and what was that like?
I was with some of the people who did Coraline, which is a fantastic film.
Right.
Some of the Academy people as well, and we were all split up. The writers there. We met some of the people from Precious, which is, you know, an amazing film.
Right.
And some of the visual effects people from Star Trek, which was great. So that's fantastic, you know. And in fact, you know, you think of the Oscars as being star-studded, but when you look at the actual list of nominees, you know, the bulk of them are behind the camera, behind the scenes, you know, editing, sound, costume, visual effects, you know. So the room was fundamentally full of people like me going, I have no idea who anyone is here. Nobody knows who I am. But, oh, look, there's Sandra Bullock. It was like that. It was nice, actually, and very informal. And we all get up and we do a group photograph, and then we go out in alphabetical order to pick up our nominee certificate, which is great.
My last question is, you know, now that, you know, this, you got the nomination, and I know you had said, you told the story sometime that you had been out to Hollywood when they wanted to do a version of Bring Your Show Out to Hollywood, and Yeah. And, you know, you'd had that kind of moment, kind of like what happens that you show in the movie. What's it like now after the nomination and, you know, this success again?
Are you... well, because the first, are you talking about when they made the television, the U.S. version of The Thick of It?
Right.
West, which was a dreadful experience. A lot of my experience of that time went into the film, actually, because that was me coming out to L.A. thinking, well, all these people seem to know what they're doing. They're all called Vice President Development and Vice President Entertainment Transduction Alliances, or, you know, there's just loads and loads of vice presidents in big plush offices, so surely they must know what they're doing. And when it turned out that for some reason or other they didn't, bad though that experience was, I've actually fed it quite a lot into the film. And when we were shooting the scenes of the British politicians coming out to Washington, you know, I told that story and I said, you know, I said to the cast, remember what it was like the first time as a young actor you came out to Hollywood and you had all these meetings and everyone loved you, and yet, you know, in the end you went home with very little. And I wanted to bring that. But it's kind of satisfying in a way, in that through doing the film, you know, I've been able to prove my point to the people here that, you know, if you just leave people who are, you know, creatively behind it, if you just leave them to get on with it, you know, they'll come up with something that works. But the problem was with the pilot, you know, I was completely at the bottom of the list and all that. So that's kind of, you know, that's a mini, little personal triumph, but not one I, you know, want to gloat about too much. It just feels so satisfying just to get through the process of making a film and making it the way you want to make it, really, and then finding that people like it and that sort of thing. That's, you know, you couldn't really ask for more, really. You'd be greedy if you were asking for more.
And to be a little greedy, what's next in the pipeline? Is it another show or another movie?
A couple of things. You know, if In the Loop is underneath all the naturalism, it's really a screwball comedy. And now the next thing I want to do is a slapstick movie. I want to do a visual comedy with lots of physical set pieces. I'm a big fan of Buster Keaton and, you know, that, or the chase at the end of What's Up, Doc, something like that, you know, where...
Wow.
You know, the choreography of the jokes is what's satisfying and what is funny. So I'm looking at that completely different from In the Loop, different world, different style, different look. We're working on the script of that at the moment. And also I've got a TV project in with HBO, which set in the world of the internet startup, another sort of ensemble piece.
Okay, that's Armando Iannucci talking about In the Loop, which is nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay this year. And thanks to Arenada Diaz, our home entertainment correspondent, for conducting that interview, because after all, In the Loop is now available on DVD and Blu-ray.
That's right.
I think you can purchase it here on the site.
You can.
I think I have a... Yes. We think of everything.
Yes, we do.
How empowering is that, to be able to walk up to someone and say, "Hi, I'm Armando Iannucci." I mean, to have a name like that.
I know, yeah. I mean, it's cool. No, that was a good interview. That was really, you know, really cool, all the stuff he was saying and about Gandolfini and stuff like that. There's a lot of great lines in that movie, a lot of funny lines in that film. I want to watch it again now. Maybe I will purchase it on our homepage.
I predict that Gandolfini will be up for an Oscar one day.
He should. He has made some really... He has been in some good, really good movies, this one. And he's... I liked him in The Man Who Wasn't There. I thought he was good in that. And, he's a really good actor. Really good.
I think so, too. And he has a movie called Welcome to the Rileys, which is another great dramatic performance that he just came off from Sundance. I think he's a very strong presence, and I think he's got some surprises in him. I'd love to see... because Polanski's been talking about adapting the Broadway show that he did, God of Carnage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
On stage it was Gandolfini, Marcia Gay Harden, Jeff Daniels, and I'm missing the fourth person, but it's Hope Davis, I think. I hope he uses that cast, you know, when he adapts it into film. It was one of the best reviewed plays last year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I would. Awesome. I would like to see him do. I'm very excited to see the new Polanski film.
Yeah, yeah. Similar reviews to Shutter Island, in that they say this is both these master directors working in the thriller genre. Polanski is more known for the thriller genre, even though honestly he hasn't done many thrillers. Polanski.
True.
Ironically enough. They say that they're both exceptional genre pieces and two of the most commercial movies that they've ever made. That's the opinion.
Okay, I could see for Polanski, definitely. Because no one would argue that Oliver Twist, The Pianist, or The Ninth Gate, or Death and the Maiden are commercial.
Yeah. Next week's Oscar nominees that we'll be interviewing or we'll be featuring on next week's show, we have Daniel Junge. So your question is, who is Daniel Junge? Daniel Junge is nominated this year for Best Documentary Short.
Okay.
For his film, The Last Campaign of Governor Booth Gardner.
Mm-hmm.
He was a governor, I don't recall which state at the moment. But he pushed for rights to die,
mm-hmm.
And it's that story. I think it was it Washington State? I think it might have been.
It might have been. It rings a bell. I'm not positive on that though.
Yeah, and we'll also have Julian Clark, who was nominated this year for Best Editing for District 9. So that's what we have so far for our Oscar nominee spotlight for next week. We did an interview, and we're about to play it, with the Oscar-nominated makeup artist behind
mm-hmm.
Star Trek. And would you call yourself a Trekkie or no?
No, because, let's see, I was always more of the Star Wars was really more the big thing for me growing up in Star Trek. But, I mean, I like the original series. Once you got to the newer stuff, I just really couldn't get into it. I like watching the movies. But I never really got into the stuff after the original, and I watched some of the Next Generation, but it never really, I can't say after that, it really took hold of me or anything. So I wouldn't call myself a Trekkie. I like Star Trek, but not a diehard.
I've never been a Trekkie or a particular fan of science fiction. So it really doesn't fall.
I gathered that about you. I had an inkling about that.
You're right. So it doesn't really fall into my realm of preferred movie choices, but I attended a convention one time.
Oh shit! Oh, this I've got to hear.
I did years ago. There was something called MagiCon. It was an annual science fantasy event, like they have Comic-Con. But
I've never been to any kind of con.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know the whole con thing. It was in high school.
Right.
So this was 20 years ago. And I know that Coppola comes out with this was after high school, because I was there about 6 months before Coppola's Dracula opened. And the whole reason why I was there was to see Coppola, because he was making a speech about Dracula.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the events. So, of course, I get there, and I'm surrounded by people dressed up, head made up. To look like Star Trek characters,
mm-hmm.
And it was surreal, and it was a lot of fun. But I thought there must be—I guess I'm cynical in a way. I was thinking there must be something missing from their lives, that these are 50-year-old men dressed up like Klingons. I don't mean to be dismissive, but it's kind of hard not to be, isn't it? I mean, it's kind of hard not to kind of make fun.
I get it. All right, I actually get it. And I really actually, have you ever seen a documentary, Trekkies?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
I get
I
it. And I mean, I thought that documentary, and I think there's a second one too, that really explains it. But dude, it's one of those things that people. I mean, I understand that people find meaning within a subculture or something.
Right. Right.
And they find acceptance, and I understand that perfectly. I'm not gonna beat around the bush. I get that. I mean, people, they feel at home. Good for them. They have that.
And I worked at the, when I worked at the theater. This is all personal stories about Star Trek. when I worked at the theater, obviously, any time a Star Trek movie opened, we would be flooded with big Trekkies, Trekkie fans, and they'd come in and they'd be dressed in the Admiral suits and everything. And I worked with someone that would lived Star Trek, and that was all he talked about, the intricacies of this and that. He gave me a big monologue one time about the Borg. And this is a guy that could not carry on a conversation about anything else. If he had to talk to someone, like really talk to them, he'd be at a loss. But backwards and forwards, he knew Star Trek. He lived it and ate it and slept it and breathed it. And, so interesting people, Trekkies. I bring this up mostly because this last Star Trek film, my impression is from interviews I've read of his, J.J. Abrams, who directed it, is not one of those Trekkies.
No, that's what I really have to say I liked about it, is that he's not. That's why I think the film works so well, is because he was able to play around, had some leeway.
Right, right. And have you heard from actual Trekkies, people that have admired and loved the series, what they think about the new Star Trek?
They, for the most part, like it.
Yeah,
they really do. You know, I have a story. Not really. When I was living in Los Angeles, I went to go see the last one. Nemesis or something, which is really bad. I mean, I don't care if you're a diehard Trekkie fan. That film it's just not very good. But I went to go see it, and a friend of mine went to the screening before me, and he just came out. And he goes, "Dude, this is the worst fucking movie I've ever seen."
And he was a Trekkie?
He liked it more. He was into it more than me. Definitely. Yeah. It was like the worst thing I've ever seen, man. Don't go in there. It's like something. Don't go in there.
It's like after someone exits a bathroom or something.
Exactly.
Like,
it was.
Don't
like,
go in there, man.
It was like my friend Josh. Don't go in there.
Wow. But Star Trek, one of the most acclaimed films of the year. The buzz was maybe it has a possibility at one of the top 10 best picture nominees.
Mm-hmm. I was surprised at it. That did surprise me that didn't make it, but I think, you know, it's I guess with Avatar, you know, you have one science fiction film in there, Avatar, and that's more than enough, I guess, in the Academy.
No, or
I don't know.
Schwarzenegger calls it Avatar.
Avatar.
Never ceases
Avatar.
To amuse me.
California loves Avatar.
Avatar.
No, you actually have two. You actually have two very good. You have Avatar and District 9. I guess it would have been nice, but I don't know.
But it did garner our next guest a nomination and his team for Best Makeup. Next guest is Barney Berman, and he comes from a family of makeup artists.
Yeah,
actually,
this is incredible.
His grandfather worked on the original Wolfman,
yeah.
Speaking of Lon Chaney. And we discussed that during this interview. And it's fascinating because I know nothing about makeup, and I'm, you know, you probably know as much as I do. And so we grilled him about what he does, and he was very generous and really informative. This is an entertaining conversation.
Yeah.
Barney Berman. So let's play it right now, and then we'll end up with our movie score of the week right after this interview. Congratulations on the Oscar nomination. How did you hear about it, and what was your reaction?
I knew that they were considering it for a nomination, and then we went, all the makeup artists who were being considered went to what's called a bake-off, and we all sort of pitched our film and talked about how we approached the makeups in those films. I kind of felt like good after the bake-off. I felt like, okay, we got a real good chance here of being nominated. There's a lot of really wonderful work, but I kind of felt like Star Trek was, you know, certainly one of the bigger productions, and I think consistently fine work from all the artists. So, that made me, you know, feel like we had a pretty good chance. And then, I don't know, between the bake-off and the day the nominations came out, it was about 10 of the longest days ever.
The 10 days that did not shake the world but shook your souls, probably.
Yeah, I just tried not to think about it, but, you know, how can you not?
No, I can imagine. Wow. And it's pretty impressive because this is like the first Star Trek film in a long time where everything, like the bar, you guys like raised the bar really high for everything that's going to come after in the series.
Thank you.
For someone who's watched all these films from my lifetime and some of the shows too, it really just, it felt new. It felt like, wow, you guys really went and upped the ante for everyone involved.
Oh, thank you. That's really, really what we wanted to do. When we first got together, myself and Mindy Hall and Joel Harlow, I told them right up front, I said, guys, I'm sure they're of like mind. I said, I don't know whether, you know, we could win any kind of award for this, but I certainly want to do work that's worthy of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, so just to be nominated, I understand why that is in itself so special. That's a sort of a jury of your peers,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. makeup artists and hairstylists, saying, great work, good job, you deserve this. And I felt like we really achieved our goal there.
Was Star Trek important to you growing up or in your adolescence?
I certainly watched the old series quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And my father was actually, for maybe a couple of years, he was William Shatner's personal makeup artist on a series called Barbary Coast and on a couple of films that he did with him.
Mm-hmm.
So I had met Bill Shatner at a young age, and I sort of had, you know, great fondness for him. So I would watch Star Trek every chance I could, the original series. But that's about as far as my fandom went. I saw the films, maybe once, except for maybe Wrath of Khan and a couple others I saw multiple times. But most of them, I would just see them once out of curiosity and appreciate them,
mm-hmm.
but wasn't a big follower of Star Trek per se.
Right. But you mentioned your father, and actually your grandfather was in the business as well, wasn't he? He did some legendary work in the makeup field.
Correct. He used to make the appliances for Jack Pierce, who, you know, made the Wolfman and Frankenstein, the Mummy. So he made the prosthetic nose piece for the Wolfman, and he made the wolf head cane for that. He used to make masks for the Twilight Zone series.
Wow.
Made like animatronic animals or animal puppets for the Jungle Book, the old Sabu movie.
Yeah,
he did really a lot of crazy stuff, props and makeup effects before there was a name for it.
Right.
Right.
So you must have, I would imagine, grown up around this environment. So were you kind of infected with the, I guess you'd call it the makeup bug, right off the bat?
To some degree, yeah. I used to love making up either myself or being made up by my dad or my brother or whomever I could get to make me up and sort of perform in makeup. I loved Lon Chaney. I wanted to be Lon Chaney. But at some point, the makeup really just sort of to kind of take over, I think partly because it was just more rewarding, both financially and just artistically, because people, and I got the chance to do it more often. I got a lot of acknowledgement for the work I did, and it was paying, so.
Right.
Well, I know that Jerry has a couple of general questions about makeup, but just to follow real quick on your beginnings, and then we'll get into more detail about the makeup, because I know you also studied acting, and you've performed throughout your career as well, and you studied under Sanford Meisner, if I'm not mistaken. How was that experience?
That was amazing. You know, I had taken quite a few acting classes since I was 14 years old, and I was in this one acting class, and I got accepted into Sanford Meisner's, and I had just signed up for this other class because I didn't think I was going to get accepted with Sandy, and I did get accepted. So I forfeited the money I put down, my down payment, whatever, for the other acting class. It was like a sign-up fee, And I just forfeited that because there was no refund, and I just dropped that class and went to City with Sandy because I recognized what an opportunity that would be.
Mm-hmm.
And about a month into his class, I just kind of like hit me. I was like, oh, I get it. I know now why I'm good when I'm good and why I'm bad when I'm bad. And I never understood that before.
Is there, because I hear as someone that's greatly enthusiastic about the craft of acting, I hear about Uta Hagen and Strasberg and Meisner. What set Meisner apart? What made Meisner unique?
Well, for me, I had actually just learned of Meisner maybe a year earlier, seeing a documentary at Dennis Hopper's house. And that turned me on to Sandy, and Dennis Hopper studied with him as well.
Right.
So I was very intrigued by him and his philosophy, his style, and it kind of felt like what I had been doing or been striving to do even before I knew what I was doing. To be able to study with the man who sort of developed it, there would just be no greater opportunity than that. So,
sure.
I had studied with Milton Caselas, and I was just signed up for a Stella Adler class. Mm. But Sandy's technique is what really kind of sort of spoke to me as a performer more than anything.
Is there something in that experience, the experience of being an actor and carrying all that training, that helps you in makeup?
Yeah, I think so. I try to feel connected to the characters that I'm making. I try to actually think of them in terms of a character that I'm creating instead of just a physical change on somebody. I try to... Even if it's not right necessarily, I try to give them a background and a history.
Mm-hmm.
And try to, if I can, get some of the actors' input as to what they were thinking and maybe put some of that into the makeup, some of the life experience. On Star Trek, for example, is one where early on JJ and I talked, and he said, there's a lot of great makeup, and a lot of times they're just too clean. And I said, yeah, absolutely. So we just agreed that, like, everybody would have a scar of some kind somewhere. So every one of the characters, aliens we made, had some kind of scar or anomaly about them
mm-hmm.
within their own structure.
Right. So, Jerry,
yeah.
Do you want to...
Well, speaking of Lon Chaney and speaking about how you incorporate the actors... my question actually refers back to when Benicio del Toro last week was making the rounds about the Wolfman movie, and when they asked about how long it took to put the makeup on, he sort of groaned and was like, "God, too long." And my question has always been, for all makeup artists, especially with these special effects films and where there's a lot of makeup, we're going back, to John Chambers' Planet of the Apes films, where it took so long to apply everything onto the actors, Roddy McDowall and Maurice Evans and John Huston. Just
mm-hmm.
how do you accommodate the actors? What is the best way to ease them into it? Because, a lot of these guys aren't used to this.
Each actor in each situation is a little bit different.
Of course.
Some take to it rather easily, and some really, really hate it. I know we did a life cast, just a life cast process of Philip Seymour Hoffman for Mission Impossible 3, and when we took it off, he was like, that was like torture. He hated it. So I was actually surprised to see his next job was like this extreme old age thing for Synecdoche.
Yeah, that's right.
But other actors really kind of get into it. Like Leonard Nimoy comes and sits down for a live cast, and he just goes to sleep. He's very, very comfortable.
It's just fascinating because you go back and you watch a lot of the old making of a lot of the old films, and I just always wondered how for the Battle for the Planet of the Apes, how they got John Huston in that makeup. How do you get someone like that? He's like, wait a second. I need a drink and I need my cigarettes. Okay, come on. Work with me here, guys.
Do you see something happening though when you apply? Do you sense that they become different as they transform as you're applying the makeup, the actors?
Some do, yeah, and some. I find the actors I think are good often will do that. I did a film called Shuffle, that the independent film we did about this time last year, mm-hmm. and the lead actor's name is T.J. Fine. He's on Bones.
Yeah. Okay.
And we did an old age makeup on him, and I guess he was aware of what he was doing, but I wasn't aware until at one point I realized when we're painting it and about to put on the wig, I realized he's not sitting up anymore. He's slouched and kind of hunched over and leaning to one side, and I kept thinking, you know, is he okay? And he just, and after that, he just stopped being TJ.
Hmm.
And from the time he got up from that makeup chair, it's like he needed somebody to help him. And he completely enveloped that old man that he was,
right.
You know, trying to be. And it was really one of the things that makes my job wonderful is when you, at some stage, you don't even necessarily always catch when it happened, but at some stage, it just, they become somebody else. They have a life of their own, and it feels wonderful to know that you helped bring that thing to life that never existed before.
Right. And you had actually worked with JJ, actually, you mentioned MI3, and you pressed him during the shooting of MI3 about the possibility of Star Trek?
I don't think he had Star Trek then. I was actually doing a film or a HBO movie called Anatomy of Hope,
mm-hmm.
a medical drama, and that's. Before that, when I heard he was going to start developing Star Trek, I called him and said, "Hey, I'd love to be interested in involved in this." And he said, "You know, at that time, he goes, I don't know what's happening. I don't know if I'm going to direct it. The script's not even written." And I said, "Okay." Then when he called me for the medical drama, I felt pretty excited because I knew Star Trek was getting close.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't say anything. I just kept my mouth shut. I came in, I did my work as best as I could. And then one day on that show, I got a call from the producers of Trek saying, "Hey, you know, we'd like to talk to you about this." And so I appropriately thanked JJ for setting me up with that interview. And he goes, "Yeah, we're going to have fun." And I was like, "Oh, okay, I guess I'm..."
That's the kind of guy he is, I would think. It's kind of a infectious enthusiasm he has as a director.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm sure he's been described by more people than I as having an infectious enthusiasm, and that's so right on. Because you go into a meeting and you're uncertain about anything, and you have this great meeting, and you come out and you're just amped. You're just all juiced and like, okay, we're going to go do it. And then you start thinking, what did we decide? I feel great. I'm ready to work.
Yeah.
What did we choose to do and not do? Oh, designs. Right, let's do that.
But you guys were under a tremendous time constraint, too, your team was with this.
It was. It was ridiculously short. I even emailed JJ a while ago. I said, if we go into the second one and I'm part of it, can we please have more time? And, you know, he certainly agrees with that. He saw what kind of ridiculous time pressure we're under. We had about 13 weeks of pre-production.
Wow.
And really, we should have had like 6 months to develop everything properly.
In that time frame, in that short time frame, how many hours a day were you working?
Me personally?
Yeah.
The
whole team, but yeah, you personally, how much time would you say?
Well, for about 5-6 months, I slept maybe 4 hours a night, and I had no days off.
Mm-hmm.
I had an amazing team of people, you know, some of which I only needed 4-10 hours a day, and others were with me the majority of the time, depending on what their job was and just their the personal level of commitment as well. But it sort of all came to a head when the first day of shooting for me started the day before the first day of shooting. I got up and I was prepping everything all day, and we had three alien heads that had to go to set. I started painting them about 8 p.m., and I finished painting them about 3:30 a.m. I wrapped them up and put them in my truck, and I drove them to set, and I was like 10 minutes late for my call. And that's just how down to the wire it was. I ended up not getting to bed again until the morning, the next morning. And so that first day was like a, well, shooting for me was a 42-hour day.
Wow.
And I just, I mean, I was crazy. I don't know, I there's no way I could have kept that up. But it was madness, and yet in my head I just kept saying, it's going to be worth it, it's going to be worth it, it's going to be worth it. And so I knew when I sat down in the movie theater and I watched this movie, I'd feel good, I'd be smiling, and I'd be proud of that.
Yeah.
And, I was right. I was happy.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm not sure the protocol or the process of this, but are screen tests normally done on makeup?
Yes. Normally, and we did test. I think each one of our aliens, we did a screen test to some degree, just for lighting and see how they'd all come together.
Right.
I think only two of them. We ended up making like a dozen full prosthetic makeups, and then maybe another 12 pullover masks, and then 12 just background shape masks to just throw in there that you don't really even see very well, but they're peppered in throughout. And I think it helps just get your mind into not everyone's human.
Mm-hmm.
What was your question?
I think you answered it.
Yeah,
the screen test process.
Yeah. Two of the full prosthetic makeups we did have to make some changes on. So we had about 3 weeks to do get a test makeup done, and then we had about a week or two, if we were lucky, to make any changes.
Mm-hmm. And I'm curious to know about this. The CGI revolution and how that affects what you do.
Well, for a couple of the aliens on this, the one you see in the very beginning, unfortunately you see it briefly, but you do see a very nice shot of the sort of long-necked, bug-like, bug-head alien.
Mm-hmm.
And the CG guys came in, Roger Gaillet and his team put an eye blink in it, and it was sweet. It was just that blink really helped sell the life of that thing,
right,
without having it to get into a big mechanic head. Also on Deep Roy's character at the end, called Keenzer, the little guy with Simon Pegg,
yeah,
Scotty. He his eyes were always set to be some kind of CG something. I don't know if they were, what exactly they're going to be. I thought they were going to be like little laser eyes. But I think they really made a great choice with the little stalks, almost like lobster eyes.
Right.
Short. So I love it when those things come together and it's, you know, planned out and you know it's going to happen. They did great stuff in Pan's Labyrinth, mixing makeups and CG.
Mm-hmm.
Del Toro is just amazing with that.
Yeah, he is.
He's got it, and he loves practical stuff. Like JJ, they love practical work on set, in camera,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to enhance it, and I'm totally in favor of that. The only thing that I wished in Star Trek was there was that sort of big, what they were calling the Polarella, the polar bear gorilla thing that comes rushing at Kirk. And I totally understand why they did it. It was so brief. It was practical, in a sense, to do it as a CG character, but I would love to have made a big suit of something like that. I think that would have been a really fun guy in a creature suit. But, you know, I'm not complaining by any means. I think they did a great job. Neville Page does amazing work. And
we had him on the show. We spoke to him about Avatar, I think.
All right.
Yeah, yeah. Jerry, did you have anything else you wanted to...
I'm very curious about the relationship, and I'm also glad that you brought up the thing about CGI, because I would imagine it more or less complements what you're doing, if done everything done right. It's all about synchronicity at the end of the day.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, it's a great tool. It's all great tools, and you always have to figure out, all right, what's the best way to achieve this particular gag, this effect, or this visual, or whatever. And sometimes it's great and fun and practical to go do it in camera, and sometimes it's just not.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't like the overuse of CGI, but I also really think the overuse of makeup. If you can sometimes if something's going to look like a puppet, you don't want to look like a puppet.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so you can overuse one or the other easily.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always just a matter of finding what's the happy balance, I think.
So what are you working on now? What's upcoming for you?
I'm actually sitting here sculpting a werewolf that I can't tell you about.
Oh,
but you just told us it's a werewolf.
Sculpting a werewolf. Werewolves are big. Wolfman's coming out. Werewolves are in. So I'm sculpting a werewolf, and I also have an alien thing that I'm about to start. The thing is, I just can't talk about that stuff.
It's all top secret.
I can tell you that in the last year, I've done Shuffle, which is the old age thing. I made some aliens that I guess if you had to compare them to anything were sort of a cross between the standard gray and the aliens.
Mm-hmm.
Something kind of in between those, if that makes any sense. For a song called Gray Skies.
Mm-hmm.
I did some horror films, something called One by One, or Doug Tate, who played the bar alien in Star Trek. I did him as the main bad guy in this horror film, One by One.
Right.
I did like six different weird indie films in the past year that have been great because they kept me very hands-on and very busy,
right?
Very creative, and it really ran the gamut from one thing to another.
Well, when you're ready to reveal,
where your werewolf
is coming from, we'd love to welcome you back on the show.
Oh, I'd love to talk about it if I could, believe me.
And we wish you the very best of luck. Oscar night.
Yeah, good luck.
Are the nerves going for you? Are you feeling nervous about the big night?
You know, I'm just really, really enjoying myself. I feel really good about the journey that I'm going through right now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not nervous about that night. I'm just looking forward to going and being there. We had an Oscar luncheon yesterday.
Yeah.
Okay.
With all the nominees. And just being there and sitting in this room and at tables amongst Meryl Streep and Jeff Bridges and Maggie Gyllenhaal and Woody Harrelson and Quentin Tarantino and Lee Daniels and all these amazing, amazingly talented people, and to be able to stand there amongst them really doesn't suck.
Was there a particular person you were dying to ask a question of yesterday?
You know, there were two people I really wanted to talk to. Others that I didn't know were going to be there or didn't think about that I talked to, which were really nice. But the two people I really wanted to talk to were Lee Daniels.
Mm-hmm.
And in part, that was because he did a film called Shadow Boxer.
Yeah, yeah.
And
that
was the first movie I got when I opened my studio, Proteus Makeup Effects.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a cold call. I was just started going through the list of breakdowns and finding who might need something that we can make. And they were doing this film out in Philadelphia. And the producer, or UPM, I talked to said, you know, it's amazing. We were just having a conversation about this.
Hmm.
So they hired us to do some babies, some pregnant bellies and other things that we sent out to them. But I never got to actually meet him. So I got to meet him and thank him. And I got to talk to Meryl Streep, who just could not have been sweeter.
Wow, that's great. Well, we're going to be rooting for you, Oscar Knight. Barney. And we really appreciate you giving us your time today.
Yeah, really. Yeah.
No, I appreciate you calling me.
Okay, Barney Berman. Star Trek, nominated for Best Makeup. You know, I have a theory, Jerry, about what he's building a werewolf for.
Okay.
Do you have an idea?
I want to say Eclipse.
The Twilight, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking either that or the next season of True Blood.
Oh, yeah. Good call. Very good call. I think it's True Blood. Because you could talk about the, because everyone knows about the werewolves and Twilight. Okay, I think that's a good call.
Yeah,
I met with Jason about that.
Yeah, I should have asked him. I should have said True Blood, and seen what kind of reaction he'd give us, and then we could tell for sure. I should have pressed him harder. We really need to get more scoops on this show.
Yes, we do. No, we sometimes get them. We get them.
Yeah, we do.
We got, my God, years ago, the James Vanderbilt, the Spider-Man 4, and that whole thing diving, going down the tubes. Yeah, we got that.
I mean, the big one was the Polanski thing.
The Polanski is the big, that's, yeah, I mean, that's a big,
yeah.
That's enormous, so.
Yeah. And also, who did we talk to about, we're talking about Terrence Malick.
Yeah.
And they brought up the Terrence Malick Great Balls of Fire script.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, oh God, I forgot where.
I can't remember who that was. But it was somebody that actually worked on Great Balls of Fire, and I brought it up to them because I've always had a special fond spot for that movie. Because it's just so kind of cartoony and fun. I mean, he really is playing like a Warner Brothers cartoon in that movie.
Right, yeah.
But the Terrence Malick script was apparently really, really dark, as a lot of Jerry Lewis's life was.
Well, it's a dark life, so yeah, that would make sense. But yeah, I remember that. You know, that was a good movie. God, I haven't seen that movie in so long. But
I remember it just being shredded when it came out. And that's what this guy was talking about. He was saying, you know, people would look at me terribly when I was at an airport because they knew I was involved in Great Balls of Fire. He kind of felt ostracized because of it.
Well, that's interesting because that came out the same summer as we've talked about this other movie, the movie version of Wired came out the end of that summer.
The Belushi, yeah.
And remember they said Michael Chiklis would never work again. He was told you will never work again.
Right.
And
this guy apparently did work again that did Great Balls of Fire because we spoke to him about something new, but for the life of me, I can't remember who it was.
No, I can't either, unfortunately.
But I'll be looking it up right after the show.
Okay.
So we're expecting Roland to call.
And it's always a good time when Roland calls.
Yeah, okay, we'll fill time for the next 3 minutes or so.
I hope he hasn't forgotten the number. I mean,
well, all he has to do is actually listen to the show.
I know.
He'll see the number.
No, but
there.
He said. I told him to call. You know, when you told me to send, I sent him an email, and he said, "Okay, that's the last transmission I got from him." So.
Right. So. Okay. So, what do you want to talk about?
Well, we haven't talked about. God, I don't know how to. Do you want
the
to
things
talk
we
about
do for
Kevin
Roland?
Smith?
Oh, the Southwest Airlines thing,
yeah.
Kevin Smith.
Mm-hmm. Do we want to go there?
Well, sure. There's a couple of opinions on this Kevin Smith thing. I was talking to Aaron last night, and he said it's moronic. He should have just dealt with it privately with Southwest, just to catch people up in case they don't know. He got kicked off of a Southwest Airlines flight because they said he was too big, too heavy, too fat, essentially. He made a big stink about it on Twitter.
Oh, yeah, enormous.
First of all, there's two points I want to make about this. Kevin Smith is known as kind of a provocateur, a frat boy. Making mischief is what he does.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, Kevin Smith has a movie out in 2 weeks. This is publicity that you can't buy. it's getting his name out there.
Right.
Everywhere, every outlet, you know, 10 days before his movie opens. So I thought it was fine.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a, I mean, I hate that, God, I just, I hate when this comes up because this shit, this, it's just so rude and just people are so nasty and the comments that I'm reading, I mean, a lot of the comments are really against him, like a lot of the forums and stuff. I was just like, you people are so cruel.
Yeah.
I am sorry.
First of all, fat people are valuable on flights because they can be used as flotation devices.
No. Look, I'm a big guy. Look, I've been the fat man in the middle seat in times of my life. I know what that's like. Okay. It's not. I know it's a. I mean, I really feel for him. I mean, I really felt really bad. That's a really humiliating thing to go through.
I felt really bad
for him.
Well, they didn't mention or stop him the whole process leading up to him boarding the plane. That was where they were clearly in the wrong.
Mm-hmm.
They waited until he was boarded, and then in front of everyone they...
Right. No, I mean, I just felt really bad. I thought at first it was a joke I had saw, and I was like, you've got to be kidding me. And, yeah, there's a cynical part of me that says, okay, this is like, you know, because the movie comes out 2 weeks, cop out. This is a big deal. This is a really big studio film from him. But I thought about that. But I was just like, you know, this is just really, really cruel. I don't care who you are. That's just really cruel. And just reading the comments and reading articles by people who are just saying, oh, well, you know, when someone says you're too fat, maybe you should just look and reevaluate your life. And maybe what can I do, you know? I was like, what the hell are these people are and give me, like, dietary advice on these
vegetables? I guarantee those people that are making those comments are fat.
I know, yeah. I mean, I just thought it was so cruel. And
people just like to
people on the internet just like to be mean and cruel. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
They're just cruel. There are a lot of cruel people out there.
Because they can remain anonymous.
Yeah, that's the whole point. Kevin Smith and Jay and Silent Bob said it best. What do people on the internet like to bitch about movies and surf for free porn? That's what people do on the internet. I just thought I couldn't believe this is where we were. This is that people that they would actually do that. Like, and I know I hear it's standard practice supposedly in the last couple of years to make you buy two tickets.
Mm.
Have you heard? I did not know this. I haven't been on. I haven't flown in a couple of years, but I had no.
Well,
idea.
Look, I'm not the biggest loser of that. But I'm a little heavier than I should be. But I'm about to board a plane in a couple of weeks, and I've never had a problem. I didn't think Kevin Smith was that.
No, I thought I was
large.
Under the impression he had lost weight. Actually, I was under the impression he was. I know he was losing weight.
Kevin Smith is Michael Moore size.
Excuse me?
Kevin Smith is Michael Moore size.
Mm-hmm.
He's probably big in the belly, but I don't see that he's, like, wide.
No, I don't see that at all. I'm sorry I brought this up. Cause I always
I'm analyzing Kevin Smith's body. What are
and
you doing?
I always get uncomfortable talking about these kind of things. I just do.
That's good. You know, and I wasn't being cynical when I brought up that his movie opens in a week and a half.
I thought about it, I was, because I had talked about that with some people, and I was being, you know, my cynical self, and, you know, I don't like to think that way. But.
I think it only brings more press to his movie, maybe. But I'm not saying he made them kick him off the plane.
No, of course not.
Yeah, he had an opportunity, so he took it. Roland, I think, is on the phone.
Yay!
Roland?
Hey, guys. How's it going?
It's going good. How are you?
Good. I was just listening to you to talk about Kevin Smith being a porker.
Leave it to you to just be the one. The man, he's like bittersweet with a razor. There you go.
We've actually held the show up.
For
We've
you.
Actually held the show up, Roland, for you.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
It seems to touch the nerve with both of you. Are you both like, yeah, you both a couple of porkers yourselves or what?
I am a devastatingly attractive man.
No, for a good chunk of my life, I would be you could say I was, I would say, grossly overweight. In the last 10 years, I've lost a lot of weight. I work out a lot, you know, diet a lot.
Right.
But no, for a good chunk, Roland, yeah, I was.
Yeah, so I see on Facebook you do boxing classes.
Yeah, I went to the first one because I took a break for a while. And I went to the first one tonight, and that was a good class. All right, no one wants to hear about my physical activity, so.
But talking about Kevin Smith,
yeah.
I didn't know that he had directed this Cop Out thing, and I've seen the trailer. It just looks like a complete pile of shit.
But his other movies, in comparison, look better to you.
I love his movies. I mean, but that's me.
Oh, Clerks! I thought Clerks was great.
Yeah.
But I didn't even know that this was a Kevin Smith film.
Well, didn't you find it interesting, Roland, that it's not, you don't mention his name at all. It's only, you know, if you look at the credits at the end, I would think for something, that's what struck me about the trailer. I would think that they would, you know, say from the director of Clerks and Chasing Amy or something,
yeah.
Or, you know, here's...
This is a big Warner Brothers movie, and that's not really a commodity for them.
No, but
it's
kind of
like
Guy
Ritchie making a move from doing his own stuff to going to do a studio film.
Mm-hmm.
He's a director for hire for the first time in this one. He didn't write it.
Yeah.
He's directing someone else's material.
But wouldn't you think in the marketing of the movie, though, too? I mean, I just find this a little odd. That's the only thing. I just say his name is nowhere in the trailer, essentially.
Right.
I would think. Wouldn't you think that would be a selling point?
I would
to get that fan base in the. Into the theater.
Yeah. So I haven't heard the show. What movies have you guys seen?
Okay. Well, we have a movie to talk about, don't we, Roland?
Yeah. Have you told
me? We have one of the best movies
that.
Of the last couple of years to talk about. One of the best trilogies, I have to say, of recent memory.
Yeah. I mean, how did you see that? Did you see that at a movie theater?
No, I didn't. We IFC on demand.
Okay.
What, Red Riding?
The Red Riding trilogy.
Yeah.
It is superb.
Yeah.
That's what I hear. I heard somebody compare it favorably to the Godfather trilogy.
David Thompson, I think it's the London Review of Books, I read the article yesterday. And he likes it just as much as the Godfather. And David Thompson loves the Godfather films. But, it's mesmerizing. It is.
Everything in it, the cast, the writing, the cinematography, the direction, it's just amazing.
I can't praise it enough for what it is. And
so this is available on IFC On Demand?
Yes.
As
one
long movie, or do you have to order three different?
You order three different things. It's 1974, 1980, and 1983. Mm. And I would put it right up there. Maybe Roland will disagree with me in what I'm going to compare it to. The Vengeance Trilogy, I think it deserves to be ranked alongside the Vengeance Trilogy and the Colors Trilogy, personally.
Right.
Yeah.
I really do.
It's hard for me, because it was made, you know, for TV, it's hard for me, but it is incredibly cinematic, but for me, as far as a piece of TV drama, it's just, which is how it aired in the UK, it's just unmatched, I think.
Yeah,
the three different time frames, but what is the common thread?
I want to say, you definitely want to say the serial killer aspect, but it's almost like the serial killer aspect of it is almost beside the point at times. It shows a deep level of police corruption, human corruption, really.
Human corruption. Everyone's corrupt.
Yeah, everyone. No, there's not a, I hate to say it, there's really not a good person in... Everyone has issues in the film. Let me put it to you like that.
So it's a documentary.
Yeah, it's a documentary.
Andrew Garfield's character was the only one that showed any kind of light in the first film.
Yeah, and you really felt for him, too. He was one of the few characters I thought you could empathize with in the whole series.
What a cast. What an incredible cast.
Some people are reading a lot of great British character actors doing some of their best work. Just some actors. I think Sean Bean was perfect.
Yeah, it's like
he
the who's who of
incredible.
British acting up there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Warren Clark was good.
Cinematography. I actually preferred the 16mm. I thought the 16mm one looked the best.
Okay.
Which was the first film.
Right.
I'll have to check that out this weekend.
It's really worthwhile. What I find interesting is there was another, you know, we get these as movies in this country, but there was another television series from Italy, The Best of Youth, that was came out as two films in this country. And that's another one that was just, and while it was originally a TV series, just totally engrossing. It was really well done. And, but yeah, the Red Riding Trilogy, I'd have to put it up there as one of the best things I've seen recently.
Yeah. I mean, and it's right out of the blue because I'm just amazed and I'm proud that a piece of TV can get made in today's economic climate, you know, that good.
Mm-hmm.
Where commissions are being cut back and budgets
right.
are being cut back. And
well, they did a lot. I mean, they did really, I mean, you got to, for a TV, and there's a lot, I mean, there's been, obviously in the last decade, there's been a lot of good TV in this country, but for something on TV to be that cinematic, that powerful,
exactly,
that
yeah.
is just floored me.
Well, British TV has been kicking ass in
mm-hmm.
recent years.
Oh,
anyway.
Well, not recent. They've always sort of kicked ass, but this thing, Jamie, is just wow.
Yeah,
just
I gotta
like,
check it out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We got a couple of emails. One email is actually a Twitter message said, "I finally listened to every single one of your shows. It only
wow.
took me 2.5 years." So I wrote him back and thanked him. That's 259 shows, including.
Wow.
That. Oh, wow.
I was thinking they're like, say, could they want probably to replace, you know, me with Ben Lyons or something. But,
yeah. If you were Ben Lyons, we'd only get a season. We also got this email here. I will be in L.A. I will be in L.A. on Oscar night. Is the event at the Kodak Theater? Yes, it is. Do you know anywhere, bar, restaurant, lounge, etc., in L.A., where a group of us could watch the awards?
Mm.
Roland, don't you live in that area?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, well, there's a ton of places going.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of
anywhere.
Places you can go. I mean,
yeah.
Go to Barney's Beanery.
Barney's Beanery.
Go to Musso and Frank's. Try to get a place in Musso.
I mean, won't every place be mayhem on that night?
Well, mayhem or completely empty. I don't know.
Yeah,
I
it depends. A lot of people
Oscar
have
party.
Oscar parties, and
yeah.
but there'll be a lot of places. There'll be a lot of like there's like around where I live, there are a lot of neighborhood bars and everything. When I lived out there, that you could go to and watch it. I mean,
yeah. Have you guys seen Wolfman?
Yeah, I saw Wolfman.
Well, I guess we're just... Okay, we've answered that question. Christine, any place. Would you recommend actually going someplace on Hollywood Boulevard where the Kodak's located? Or
no,
avoiding that altogether?
Unless they like the crowds and everything. But I would imagine it'd be like talk about total mayhem. That's gonna be insane.
I would wait until after the awards to go to a restaurant or bar because that's when you'll see all the people coming out of the Oscars.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, go to In-N-Out. That's probably where you'll see the most stars after
true,
the Oscars.
True. True.
Have any of us seen what? You were about to ask something.
No, Wolfman.
Wolfman. Yeah, I saw it. We talked about that earlier.
Did you like it or not?
Yeah. I could take or leave it. I mean, I don't think it's like as horrible as everyone makes it out to be, but it's not you watch it and you're just like I was telling Jamie earlier, it reminded me a lot of the Ang Lee movie The Hulk.
Yeah.
That kind of had that same kind of dynamic going.
It was funny. I mean, funny in a stupid way. It's like a throwback to the old style horror movie. Him like running around. It's kind of comical, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's comical, but I gotta say, I prefer, you know, the Lon Chaney one is still like the best one. But there's some parts I appreciated. There are other parts I was just like, you gotta be kidding me. But you know, it's not. I can't say it's something you walk in that you're surprised at that because the movie was plagued with a lot of problems. It was delayed. So I can't say it's surprising. It's like, you know what, unfortunately, like what most, not most, but some big films are, you know, it's hit and miss. You know, it's not horrible. It's not great. It's like somewhere in between.
Yeah, I thought the world that they created, the time and the cinematography and everything was good. It was just the story and the
mm-hmm.
character.
Right.
It's just a strange film. I saw Crazy Heart.
Did you like it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did, yeah. I thought Jeff Bridges is the performance of his career.
I wouldn't disagree. I mean,
I
think it's as good as anything he's done.
Yeah.
I saw a movie that I hadn't seen previously.
Mm-hmm.
Leap Year?
No, I haven't checked that out
yet. I
want to
see Leap Year. I do want to see that.
Oh, in spite of Roland's recommendation.
No, I just want to see Leap Year, okay? All right.
Jamie saw Dear John.
Dear John. I said, Dear God, Dear John.
Valentine's Day, Jamie. You saw that.
What? What did Jamie see? What?
Valentine's Day.
I saw Capitalism, A Love Story.
Oh, okay.
I hadn't seen that previously.
Mm-hmm.
It came in and I watched it. I loved it. It's hard to say when you talk about favorite Michael Moore. It's hard to say because they're all, I find them so very good,
mm-hmm.
and of equal importance in the issues they tackle. For some reason, I have a special affinity for Bowling for Columbine because
yeah.
I think
mm-hmm.
the questions it asks are so unique, and he doesn't necessarily bother to answer them. So there's a lot of thinking that you do beyond the movie experience.
Mm-hmm.
This one is heartbreaking and very accomplished.
Yes,
in that it makes such a complex world, economic world, digestible to you.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's the most polished in terms of technique or editing,
mm-hmm.
But it does its job. I thought it was very good.
Do you think, now, I remember when he was on Bill Maher last season, and there was an impression that this was the last thing he was going to do for a while.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that's not true, because I think there's a ton of stuff going on right now in this country that he needs to address. I would love to see him do something on the teabag movement. I really would. I'd love to see him go after all that kind of stuff, because it's
yeah.
perfect fodder for him.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that the teabag movement in particular is a problem as much as the phenomenon of these kind of rogue groups that are popping up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Out of discontent for, you know, whoever's in power.
I would love to see him address this. I really would.
Well, these are big issues that he does.
Mm-hmm.
He tackles violence in Bowling for Columbine.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Terrorism in 9/11.
Yeah.
And the economy in capitalism. I mean, these are huge canvases. So he should be applauded for that. He shouldn't be the only one out there doing it. He probably takes the stance that Oliver Stone takes. He says, the mantle needs to go to somebody else now. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I've put my time in.
Oh, he has. There's no doubt about that. But he does it so well.
Well, he's the best at it.
Mm-hmm.
Roland, what's your impression of Michael Moore? Or do you do impressions?
I like Michael Moore. I think by doing the documentaries that he's done, I think after Bowling for Columbine and Fahrenheit 9/11, maybe he lost his audience after the first two films. So I think he's got his hardcore followers.
Mm-hmm.
But I think he's probably become a polarizing filmmaker now.
Yeah, I don't see, when you're someone like that, and also like Oliver Stone too, very polarizing figures. There doesn't seem to be a middle ground.
There is a danger of the film, especially in like documentary filmmaking, of the director overpowering the material. I mean, outstarring the actual material. And, and you're right, he's become a polarizing figure. And reasonably so, because, first of all, he's made himself the center of a lot of these movies.
Also because, you know, people like Bill O'Reilly and everyone gunning for him.
And that too, because some of his movies are a little too simplistic for me. This one, I think its strength is that it goes after everybody that's been a part of this. It knows no parties really. It doesn't differentiate between the Republican corruption or the Democratic corruption.
Yeah,
they're all part of it.
He touches on a Democrat. He also touches on the influence of Goldman Sachs. And there's a lot of Goldman Sachs alumni in the Obama administration. And he does touch on that. And I think that he or someone else, while many journalists have written about Goldman Sachs and how they've profited, how they really have not been hurt at all by anything that's going on, I do think someone, probably as we speak, is working on doing a documentary on the influence of Goldman Sachs. And that's a big story. So
we're seeing a lot of this. We're seeing the Abramoff movie and documentary.
Mm-hmm.
We're seeing the damages this season is dealing with the financial. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it's a great movie.
It is.
But I think it's a credit to this country that a filmmaker like that, despite of his criticisms of the system here and people's criticisms from other countries of the States, I mean, where else would you get a film made like that so self-aware and self-critical and get a distribution deal?
Right.
True.
Well, he's in bed with the Weinsteins. But he's also it's also his most personal one too, I think, because
I think so, yeah.
I mean, he brings his father into it. You get footage of him as a kid. I mean, so I liked it. We're gonna close with the movie score of the week. Did you want to bring up anything else, Roland, before we close out?
No, not that I can think of, guys. I saw a movie on the TV last night, Elegy, which I thought was...
Love it.
Yeah.
That was good. I like that one a lot.
I love it, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, it's no Dear John, but...
No.
Not much can be
Dear John. I really like Elegy. I thought Elegy was... And that we were talking about that a couple of weeks ago, because we were talking about Dennis Hopper. And and I thought that was one of the best performances he's given in a very long time in that film.
Yeah.
Last week's movie score of the week was Signs from James Newton Howard. This movie score of the week is actually not a movie. It's a miniseries.
Okay.
But it's as accomplished as any movie that you'd pay to go see at a theater.
Okay, now I'm really curious.
That's all I'll tell you guys about it before I play it. So we'll reveal it next week. Next week when we have Julian Clark, the Oscar-nominated editor of District 9, and Daniel Johns, the Oscar-nominated documentary short subject, The Last Campaign of Governor Booth Gardner. Those are the two that are confirmed for next week. As we continue our Oscar nominee series. Guys, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
All right.
Roland, hope to talk to you again next week.
Yeah, take care, guys.
All right. Good night, everyone.
Bye, everybody.
Bye. Bye.